Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. For anyone who ever wanted to know about the cost of war, this is the book. That's how Ron Nixon, Global Investigations Editor at the Associated Press, describes the book Bravo Company by Ben Kessling, a Sarah graduate who went on to Wabash College and then to Harvard. Today, he's a Midwest correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. A former Marine infantry officer in Iraq and Afghanistan, he now focuses on domestic security and veterans issues. Ben Kessling joins us from Chicago. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ben.
Tom, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us about Bravo Company and why you chose to focus on the unit's experiences in Afghanistan.
I first heard about Bravo Company a few years ago. I wrote a story about them for the Wall Street Journal back in 2019. They were 10 years after their after a harrowing deployment into the Arghandab Valley of Afghanistan, where they really saw very few firefights, and they mostly saw IEDs. So they didn't get to come face-to-face with the Taliban very often. They came face-to-face with the remnants, the trails, the signs of the Taliban. And those IEDs, over time, led to something nearing a 50% Purple Heart rate for the company. They had a harrowing deployment. And when they came back, after about 10 years, there were a few suicides, some folks who were having suicidal ideations. Military unions have been happening since the first soldiers went to war. But this one sought to bring the entire group back together, and as many of them as possible, all expenses paid, so the cost was no obstacle for these men. And then once they were there, the VA sent counselors and folks there to sort of mediate that reunion, because military reunions, for anybody who's ever been in the military, knows they often devolve into telling old war stories again and again and telling dirty jokes. And having the VA there, they could help those guys dig deeper into those war stories and unpack what was making, you know, where the jokes came from. So by the end of it, they had sort of a therapeutic framework as a group, and they were able to sign up for VA services, and they all reconnected. So that's how I first met them. And then I decided to dive deeper and to tell their story, and to, you know, almost to answer some questions for them. Why were they in Afghanistan? How did they get sent to where they were at? Who ultimately decides to push the button that sends a unit where a unit ends up in a country? So I found that out for them. I went and dug a little bit into those pre-deployment decisions, followed them through the deployment, and then followed them for the 10 years after, their successes, men's successes and failures, men's troubles and growth, and just followed the sort of entirety of the veteran experience.
You also followed them through what you describe as a major shift in the unit's mission. What happened? Tell us about that shift and why it was significant.
Right. So one of the things that was fascinating when I started digging into Bravo Company's deployment story, when I was asking that question of, I wanted to answer for them why they were there. And as I started digging into it, it was a fascinating story. So Army units are like nesting dolls, right? Units fit within units fit within units. So you have at the smallest level, the individual soldier. Soldier's part of a fire team. That's part of a squad. That's part of a platoon, and on up until you get to entire armies and the entire Department of Defense. Well, Bravo Company was part of a battalion that was part of a brigade. And a brigade at the time was really the smallest unit that you could move around like a chess piece on the strategic board, a brigade of about 4,000 troops. And when Bravo Company deployed in 2009, they went over to Afghanistan with no real mission, which, again, for folks who know the military, for any listener who's been in the military, it's mind-boggling to think something happens without a mission, because whenever we do something military, we do it with a task and a purpose. We do it with a mission, because there's no reason to send somebody out there willy-nilly. They need to have a reason for being out there. And it turns out that Bravo, as part of this 4th Brigade that they were nested underneath, they went at the beginning of the Obama administration when the president was trying to decide what he was going to do with Afghanistan. He knew he wanted to do something, but he didn't want to rely on George Bush's plans and wanted to have his own way forward. And part of that way forward was surging troops into Afghanistan. Hadn't decided how to do it yet. And a brigade was sent almost as a SOP, as an interim thing before the surge was announced. that's how those guys ended up in Afghanistan. They started out on what's known as a training mission, an advise and assist mission. So there were all these units under 4th Brigade, Bravo Company is one of them, and they were tasked with working with Afghan police and military units doing training missions. Well, Bravo Company was under a battalion who had a very hard-charging commander, and that hard-charging commander, he was going to do his job well. He was going to do this training mission as he was tasked, but he did his best to find a way to get his paratroopers into combat, into the thing that they'd been trained to do, that they'd been promised they would do ever since they raised their hand and signed up at that recruiter's office. And he got them into that combat, and that combat got them to shift mission. And that battalion went into the Argandab River Valley, and Bravo Company was part of the battalion. And that's when their mission shifted to have something new, fighting as paratroopers rather than advisors to the Afghan military. And that's when they started finding those IEDs and started incurring injuries.
You walk us through that very clearly. On starting on page 200, you describe some of the fine details of the surroundings, the trees, the greenery of the Afghanistan spring that make just about every step forward a roll of the dice. So you're constantly on high alert out there. And that state of mind alone must take a toll.
That's right. And I wrote Bravo Company in third person. I'm telling their story. But my experiences as a Marine officer and having been on deployment myself informed the telling of this. And I was able to sort of infuse the book with things that I had thought about when I was on deployment. And, you know, when you're on deployment, remember the oddest things. They remember smells. They remember sounds. They remember, you know, the way a certain tree sat. And for these guys in Bravo Company, they remembered the feeling of walking through these lush fruit yards. So the Argandab Valley is known for having some of the greatest, if not the greatest, pomegranates in the world. And farmers down there grow pomegranates and grapes in these dense orchards using very old irrigation systems. And the irrigation systems, the orchards and the vineyards end up looking a lot like hedgerows from World War II. Pre-made defensive positions for whoever is in that land. And the Taliban was able to take advantage of that and lay bombs in those areas in ways that it was impossible, even with the greatest drones, weren't able to see them do that. And Bravo knew when they went out on patrol that they had to try to find these things and to find them not by stepping on them, but by detecting them and having explosive ordnance disposal people come out and take care of them. But it was impossible to find all those in that way. And so every mission out of the wire, there was a dreadful sense of who's next. Is it going to be me? Is it going to be my friend? You have black jokes that they would tell, dark jokes about, hey, you know, if I just lose a leg, it's not a big deal. Or, hey, if I, you know, if I only lose two legs, it's not a big deal. And that's the kind of like dark humor these guys had in order to keep going out of that wire every day and patrolling those areas. When you're in a situation like that, you can't just sit back in your patrol base, because if you do that, then you cede all that ground to whomever's out there and they'll just set in more IEDs. So the only way for them to try to counter this and to dominate the territory was to go on offensive patrols. But going on those offensive patrols was stepping into IED-laden territory every day. And it's almost unimaginable the sort of nervous anxiety and toll that takes on someone, knowing that today could be their day.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned early on the very high proportion of the unit that wound up with Purple Hearts. And by the time these soldiers made it back home, what had happened to them?
You know, they didn't all come home at the same time. Some of these guys came home early because they went to Walter Reed, or they were buried in Arlington. But when the men came home, it's an odd thing. A deployment ends, and I try to convey this in the book at the end of the deployment. I sort of end the deployment with one sentence. I say, then it was all over and they came home. Because when a deployment ends, you just sort of, over the course of a few days maybe, but really it's almost like a whistle sounds at the end of a game, and everybody packs up from that unit, turns over to the next unit, and heads home. And then a unit in the United States military doesn't stay a cohesive group through its entirety. It's a little like George Washington's hatchet, right? Like the head gets replaced and the handle gets replaced so many times that there's no real original parts left over. So as soon as a unit gets back from deployment, men scatter to the wind. They'll go on leave for a little while, then they'll go to schools, they'll go to other units, new troops will come in, and there's a dispersal that occurs. And it really can make it so that it feels like you're unmoored. The people that you went through this experience with, the men on your left and right who know deeply what you went through and you know what they went through, you move to different units and things restart, and that unit is reborn with a lot of new personnel, and it can make you feel as if you've been cut adrift sometimes. And that's not just for this unit. This is for other units throughout the military.
Well, the Department of Veterans Affairs declared members of Bravo Company as at extraordinary risk, and members of the unit were chosen to be test subjects for a new group approach to the veterans crisis. How has that worked out? Does it seem promising?
Well, Tom, it's one of those things that you don't want to say too much early on because you're afraid that it'll jinx the outcome almost. But as of right now, it's time we're speaking. There's been no more suicides in Bravo Company, and the men have done a better job of remaining connected to each other and recognizing that there's something about that group approach, about being with men who have had a congruent experience with you, the exact same equal experience, and knowing what that's like. And Bravo was, they were extraordinarily fortunate because their leadership, their senior leadership, their company commander, who was a captain at the time and is now a lieutenant colonel, has remained connected to these men. The man who was their top sergeant, who ended up getting out of the military as a sergeant major, he still remains connected to them, and that they've carried through some of that leadership 10 years later down the road. And all of those men, including the leaders and the sergeants who were around at the time, they've all stuck around to give that sort of cohesiveness to the group that remains. And when the VA and a veteran service organization partnered together to bring these men together for this reunion, they sort of stoked those embers and reminded them of how important it is to stay connected and stay together. Because a lot of times, for anybody who knows a veteran and is listening to this right now, or is a veteran themselves, they know that it can seem like the VA treats you as if you've never been a part of a team, that you go in as an individual, you get individualized treatment from an individual therapist, individual prescriptions, individual treatment plans, and they try to heal you as an individual. But that's not the way that healing occurs. And to have a group of people around you with strong arms and with open hearts and a knowledge of you and a love and a care for you, that's how healing happens. And that's the type of group that really matters. And when the VA decided to test this pilot program, this was happening when there were troubles with the VA crisis line. Veteran suicide seemed to be an intractable problem. And on some level, the VA was like, hey, look, we're not about to crack this nut. So let's try this. Let's try something new, see how it works. And that was part of the impetus behind this pilot program. And it seems to have something behind it. It seems to remind us that just as in the military, just as in the Army, the men relied on each other as a team, and they're doing the same now that they're veterans.
All right. Bravo Company will be published by Abrams Press on November 1st. We've been talking with the author, Ben Kesseling, Midwest correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, former Marine infantry officer in Iraq and Afghanistan, father of four, and a two-day Jeopardy champion. Ben, thank you so much for your service and for this important work.
Tom, I very much appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Travis Martin joins us now from Richmond. Dr. Martin is founding director of the Kentucky Center for Veteran Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. And I wanted to talk with him about some of the issues raised in Ben Kesseling's book, Bravo Company. Thanks for joining us, Travis.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
As Ben Kesseling pointed out, veterans often come home alone, separated from the people that they've been in combat with, people they've protected or who have protected them. They've been close. Why do veterans come home alone when so many say they support them?
Well, I mean, it's not like past wars. Whenever people would deploy from their home region or their hometown, even where they were drafted or whatnot, we'll have sometimes our National Guard or reserve units are like that. But for the most part, when our active duty troops come home, like the unit that Ben Kesseling observed, they're going back to very different places. They're going back to the places they came from. And so the closeness they found, that family they found, is suddenly at a very distant place where they can't access that for the support and the guidance that they need.
Would you say that there is this idea that in order to heal, veterans supposedly have to exist in what amount to closed societies? Because Kessling talks about this experiment that the VA has underway to kind of counter that.
Yeah, Operation Resiliency. I think I agree with Kessling in terms of extremely traumatized veterans, that first step does tend to be a group of your fellow vets. Being able to talk to someone about things that you're not sure how other people are going to take can be really hard, especially combat, death, and dying, and the types of things that Bravo Company went through. But, you know, I think at some point, though, we need to go beyond that. So what's the next step for all these veterans that are coming back and they're going into their closed circles and their groups and they're figuring things out, and then they want to take that next step out? Well, they can't only be a part of an insular veteran culture to do that. They have to, at some point, embrace and rejoin the larger collective that they were part of. But that's hard because so few people in our society know what veterans go through. Because, and some of that's because the healing takes place behind closed doors. And some of it's because veterans don't know if they stack up or not, if they're going to be able to match the conceptions of veterans that others have. And so for veterans themselves, it's a society that's very individualistic as opposed to being very collectivist, like what they're used to in the military. The military taught them to look out for the person to your left, to your right, and to go after higher ideals and really try to put your heart and soul into those. Out here in American society these days, it feels more and more to the veteran as though everyone's out for themselves, and that can be alienating, and it can be off-putting, and it can make you feel as though other people are unapproachable to talk to about your issues.
You know, there is this barrier, too, isn't there, between veterans and civilians, and I have my own situation to relate to. I have a new son-in-law who's a former special operations and in Afghanistan and went through some pretty rough stuff over there, as you can imagine. And I'm struggling with how to talk to him about that. I think we fear that we're going to trigger awful memories and cause discomfort or harm to that person. Is that a misunderstanding? Do veterans really want us who have not experienced what they've experienced to ask them about it?
Absolutely. And I can say that for absolute certainty because I've seen it again and again. In our program, every student goes out and finds a veteran in the community and asks them about their service. And not once has a student come back to me and said, I am severely worried about my veterans' well-being. There is this stereotype that we assume that veterans, all of them, have gone overseas and they've experienced some extremely horrible trauma, and the mention of service even will just kind of bring them to their knees. And it's unfortunate because it prevents a lot of important conversations from taking place, the types of conversations that need to take place in order to heal, to get better, and to find out who you are after service. But instead, we've replaced that with platitudes and rituals. And so, you know, I said the other day in class, and I say this every semester, that I don't think etching your name on an enlistment contract makes you a hero in its own. Can it be brave? Yes. Can it be courageous even? Sure, in a time of war. But for the most part, the decision to enlist on its own is not an heroic act. To be a hero, you have to do something heroic in a moment. And so in the military, they have medals for these sorts of things, and they're medals for valor. You may have heard of the Medal of Honor, Bronze Star, things like that, Silver Star. But when veterans get back, they're told they're all heroes. And they kind of get lumped together monolithically. And at the same time, on the other side of that coin, there's this kind of mentality that veterans are victims, that they are all necessarily traumatized by their service. And therefore, it's a bad mark in their life. It's either you're superficially praised on one hand and you never get a chance to talk about your experiences and share with people what you learned and how you grew, or you are portrayed as a victim and you're unable to talk about your experiences because people are afraid to talk to you about it. They're afraid that they're going to set you off. And so this hero and wounded warrior dynamic is something that's been talked about differently by about a lot of people, but it's something that is pretty ubiquitous for the post 9/11 generation in particular, because those veterans are coming back to a society, I believe, that is isolated them because of the ways in which they deployed and the nature of modern warfare, that these stereotypes have kind of emerged as placeholders for a lack of understanding on the civilian's part. And so what we're teaching in veteran studies and the type of things that people like me write about is ways to break down those barriers. And I almost always come to the conclusion that I could do more work on the civilian side of the equation and teaching them how to talk to a veteran, teaching them how to show authentic communication skills and respect. And oddly enough, I find myself teaching empathy, I believe, in my classes, just this ability to look at a veteran and not see a blank-faced kind of marble statue of what, you know, your ideal veteran is, but rather to see a human being, someone that could have been you or someone you love placed in extraordinary circumstances. If you can get to that point, I believe we could really start to help a lot of veterans.
So it sounds like we civilians have our work cut out for us here to reach out and really try to understand these veterans in ways that fundamentally alter the communities that welcome them home.
Yeah, I would say that's true. And it's a two-way street, though. So, you know, taking account veterans on their side of the equation have to be willing to, you know, open up to the civilian and recognize that civilian may be trepidatious about having that conversation, that they're worried about offending or saying the wrong thing. And that basically what's happening in this situation is that veterans are coming into this conversation with perceptions of misperceptions. So they're thinking, what do they think about me? And the civilian's thinking, well, what do they think about what I'm saying right now? And all of this dialogue that should be taking place is being replaced with a song and dance. And some of it's scripted for us in our rituals, and some of it is just a lack of knowledge that we kind of dance around instead of addressing the important hard-hitting issues Kegling has in his book.
Well, your veteran studies program, how does it accomplish this?
Well, for one, you know, we're putting hundreds and hundreds of students out into the community every single semester to go and talk to veterans. For two, we are equipping students who are going into a wide range of professions, predominantly the helping professions like healthcare and policing and nursing and social work and things like that. We're equipping them with a credential that will allow them to say, not only can I do my job like the person next to me with the same degree in this interview, but your veteran patients, your veteran family members of those patients, the people that are coming in here with unique cultures and identities and experiences that I've just elucidated, we don't really understand. I'm putting students out into the workforce through this program that are capable of recognizing veterans' needs and having those conversations. I'll give you an example if there's a moment.
Sure.
I have a student who is completing her capstone right now as a nursing major, hasn't finished her degree yet, but she told me the other night a veteran, a Vietnam age veteran, came in, an amputee, and he was refusing to allow the doctors and the nurses to draw blood. And he was mentioning his service, and he was just agitated, and he didn't want to be approached. And this student was able to just basically walk up to the veteran and be nice to him and not say thank you for your service. And because when he said, she would have said that, it would have basically negated everything he was going through in the moment. It would have asked him to exist as a symbol of who he was in the past. It would have ignored the pain he was experiencing in the present. Instead, she just kind of said, hey, I heard in there that you were a veteran. That's, you know, I think that's great. And I understand that people who serve have been through a lot. All she did was tell him about the Veteran Studies Program. And she tries to learn every day more about veterans and the communities that they're in. And I think we all got to take two steps back, you know, think, you know, what do you normally say when you say to a veteran, just throw that out the window, and think, what do I normally say when I would say to anyone, and have a genuine curiosity to learn more about that service, because you know that learning more about that service is part of that veteran's homecoming process. I argue that process is lifelong. It does not begin and end when the person goes in and when the person gets out, but rather it goes on for the rest of their lives. And Kegling says something similar in his own book. He says that in writing this book, I learned that no veteran service is ever finished. Well, I would say the same thing, because veterans and service are so intertwined. You know, a veteran's core identity is somehow linked to service, nationally at first, but you'll see again and again veterans trying to find ways to serve when they get out. And so I see continued service as part of homecoming. And so another way to help vets, give veterans that opportunity. Give them the opportunity to serve in their jobs, in their schools, in their home communities, places where they can continue to teach and be a part of something bigger than themselves, because that's really the reason they joined in the first place. If you not feel that anymore, that can be a little alienating on its own.
Well, this is really great work you're doing there, and everybody, I think, should appreciate it. Travis Martin, founding director of the Kentucky Center for Veteran Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up after the break, a copyright case before the Supreme Court with serious implications for American arts and culture, an effort to include all in the enjoyment of the great outdoors, and our election series on the local offices on the ballot. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable and trusted energy information. Co-ops offer updated electric vehicle news and an EV calculator to help members make the change to charging. More information at togetherwesaveky.com. WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Copyright is a peculiar thing. Everyone thinks they understand it, but they're usually wrong. And that's a problem because copyright is supposed to help authors manage the market for their work and to understand when they're infringing on somebody else's work. Unfortunately, it's hard to know for sure because courts disagree about when it's fair for copyright to let authors use a work without permission and when it isn't. And that's the opening paragraph of an article on undermain.art about a case now before the U.S. Supreme Court that has important implications for the future of American art and culture. The author is University of Kentucky Law Professor Brian Fry, and he joins us now. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Brian.
Great to talk to you. Glad to be here.
So let's set the scene for our listeners, if we can. Tell us about this case that was argued before the Supreme Court on October 12th.
Right. So this is a copyright infringement case brought by a photographer by the last name Goldsmith against Andy Warhol for several paintings that Warhol made using a photograph that she took of the rock star Prince. So essentially what happened was back in the early 80s, Goldsmith had a photographic session with Prince, which was potentially going to be included in a Newsweek magazine article. So it was sponsored by Newsweek. Newsweek ended up actually publishing a different one of her photographs, not one of the ones from this session, but she kept all the photographs of prints that she took and licensed them out to anyone who wanted to use them for various kinds of journalistic or other purposes. So some of the photographs she took were published in different magazines. Several years later, Vanity Fair licensed one of Goldsmith's photos for use as a reference for an illustration that was going to be created for a story that they were running on Prince. And Goldsmith went ahead and licensed the photo for that purpose to Vanity Fair for $400. Unbeknownst to her, the illustrator in question was none other than pop artist Andy Warhol. Warhol created 16 of his signature style paintings using the Goldsmith photo, reframing it so that the prince's face was bigger, creating a silk screen, which he used to silk screen 16 canvases and works on paper, which he then included different colors and different kinds of additional graphic elements, as he so frequently does. And Vanity Fair chose one of those photos to use as the illustration for its story on Prince. Fast forward like 20 years, when Prince dies, Vanity Fair runs a homage article about him, and they reprint this illustration that Warhol created they'd run previously. Goldsmith sees this image and realizes that Warhol used her photo, which he hadn't realized before, apparently, and starts making noises about bringing some kind of infringement action, or at least asking for royalties of one kind or another from the Warhol Foundation for Warhol's use of her photograph to create 16 images rather than just one illustration, and for continuing to license those illustrations. So when Vanity Fair ran the illustration for the second time, they actually paid a $10,000 licensing fee to the Warhol Foundation. So then what happened was the Warhol Foundation, fearing a copyright infringement action, filed what's known as a declaratory judgment action in federal court in New York. And effectively what that means is they went to the court and said, we have reason to believe, good reason to believe, that this person is planning to bring a copyright infringement action against us. And we want you to declare that we are not infringing, that the paintings that Warhol created are not infringing paintings, because we have good reason to believe that she's otherwise going to sue us, and we want to preemptively choose a venue and get a decision in our favor. The district court ruled in their favor, but then the Second Circuit reversed, holding that Warhol was in fact an infringer and that his use of the photograph was not a fair use under the circumstances. So then the Warhol Foundation appealed to the Supreme Court, which heard the case a little while ago, and it's still pending. So we're expecting a Supreme Court decision sometime probably next year.
So, Brian, what makes the case so especially challenging?
Well, so for one thing, the fair use doctrine in general, I think, is confusing a little and misunderstood in a lot of cases, and it's hard to predict how fair use cases are in practice going to come out. But we haven't heard a whole lot of anything from the Supreme Court about it since then, and different lower federal courts have developed really different ways of thinking about when uses of a copyright-protected work are fair or when they're not fair. And that's really important because at its heart, copyright is really all about regulating speech. It's not just about money. It's about at least potentially controlling what people have to say. And fair use is one of the ways that we protect free speech in the face of copyright enforcement. We don't want people to use copyright to prevent people from engaging in critical activities and expressive activities and educational activities. And so fair use is one of the ways that we help kind of realize those First Amendment speech protective goals.
Well, you just touched on those activities. There are four factors that go mm-hmm. into consideration in determining whether a particular use of work is fair use. What are those mm-hmm. four factors?
Right. So fair use is sort of like a set of principles that were developed by the courts to explain when it was inappropriate to allow copyright owners to enforce copyright infringement against a defendant who is using their work in particular ways. That was eventually codified in the Copyright Act of 1976, which did two different things, right? First, the preamble to that statute kind of explains why we have fair use. And it says that, you know, use for critical, educational, expressive purposes are non-infringing because we want to encourage those kinds of uses and we don't want to prohibit them. And then it gives four factors that it says courts should think about when they're determining whether or not a use is or is not a fair use. And I think that's important to recognize because frequently people look at the four factors and say to themselves, and particularly courts actually, will look at the factors and say, okay, well, we just think about these factors when we ask whether or not a use is fair or not. The statute suggests we should be thinking more holistically and that the factors are kind of a way of guiding our analysis. But effectively what they do is they say that you should look to the nature of the use, right, which is typically understood to be, is it a transformative use of the original work, or are you just reproducing the work without making any meaningful change to the nature of the work or how it's being used, right? What kind of work is it, right? If the original work is a factual work, like a newspaper story, then copying elements from a newspaper story doesn't really infringe on the kind of copyright value as much as it would if it were, say, a creative work, like a poem or something along those lines. How much of it do you use, right? So are you, you know, copying the entire work? Or are you copying just part of it? Were you copying just as much as you needed to? Or were you copying the whole thing just because it was interesting and you thought your readers would like it better if you copied more? And then finally, what's the effect on the market for the original? In other words, is the work that you created that's doing the copying in effect a kind of market substitute for the original work? Or is it something that's totally different where consumers would either want to consume both of them or they might not look at them as being in the same market at all?
So the case seems to boil down to that word transformative. Is transformative clearly defined in law?
It's not defined at all. Right. And in fact, transformative isn't the word transformative actually isn't even included in the text of the fair use statute itself. It does appear in the discussion of derivative works. And frequently or typically a work that's potentially a fair use is a derivative work of an original. It's a work based on another work rather than a direct copy of it. But the inclusion of the concept of transformativeness was actually largely the function of a legal scholar who's also a judge named Pierre Laval. So he's a judge on the Second Circuit. And he wrote a really influential law review article arguing that the first fair use factor, which goes to the nature of the use in question, ought to be understood as asking whether or not the use that was being made of the work was or was not a transformative use. And the Supreme Court took up Laval's proposition in its opinion in Orbison v. Two Live Crew case. So they kind of wrote that principle into law in that judicial opinion without really totally specifying exactly what they meant by transformativeness. And as a practical matter, transformative can mean a lot of different things depending on the context, right? So we might think of transformativeness as being taking an existing work and changing it in some way that it informs our understanding of a new work without actually being directly copied. But we can also think about transformativeness as transforming the way that the work is used. So, for example, in the Google Books case, Google was scanning all the books in a whole bunch of different libraries in order to enable people to do different kinds of frequency, word frequency searches and look for snippets and that kind of thing. And the Supreme Court said that that was a transformative use of those books, because even though Google was copying the entire books, it wasn't copying them for the purpose of enabling people to read them. It was only copying them for the purpose of enabling people to figure out what kind of stuff was in them. So in effect, it wasn't participating in the same market. It was using the works for a totally different purpose, right? So what courts mean by transformative for the purpose of the fair use analysis can be really contextual. A lot of people have kind of come around to the idea that maybe thinking about fair use in terms of transformativeness isn't necessarily the right way to go, precisely because it's sort of so nebulous and so dependent upon the perspective of the person doing the analysis. And maybe we ought to think more about the nature of the use in question, whether or not the use is competing with the copyright owner's use of the work in question, and the extent to which the use being made of the work is meaningfully expressive and sort of demanded by First Amendment values.
Well, listener, if you want to dig into this, want to know more about the case now before the Supreme Court, you can find Brian Fry's full article online at undermain.art. And we've also posted a link to our site, esweku.org. Brian, this sounds like a prime example of how art or creativity is being impacted by digital technology. What would be the repercussions across arts and culture in the event that the court rules in favor of the Warhol Foundation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, I think it's one that really didn't get addressed head on in the oral argument before the Supreme Court, or really, unfortunately, I think even in the briefing as well as it might have been, although some of the amicus briefs did touch on this question. But it's very hard for me to see how the Supreme Court or any court would come up with a rule that said that Warhol's use of the Goldsmith photo was an infringing use of the photo and therefore could be prohibited, without effectively saying that the better part of contemporary art is at least potentially copyright infringing. I think that would be a real problem and an outcome that would be really unfortunate. And I do hope the Supreme Court takes that into account when evaluating what it's going to do in this case. As you suggest, I think we're likely to see a whole lot more of this same kind of thing in the near future as AI image generators and AI text generators become more and more popular and heavily used. And a lot of people have concerns that they produce works that look really similar to works that have been made by other artists and authors. And I think there'll be questions about the extent to which the way that they function implicates a lot of these fair use style questions.
All right. I've been talking with University of Kentucky law professor Brian Fry about copyright law and Andy Warhol Foundation versus Goldsmith, a case currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you so much, Brian. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Jerry Sebo James is with us. Jerry is coalition lead with Together Outdoors. It's administered under the Outdoor Recreation Roundtable, and he's here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Jerry.
Welcome, Tom. I'm glad to be back on the show.
What is Together Outdoors?
So Together Outdoors is a coalition that is really diverse, includes a lot of folks in different companies, nonprofits, public agencies from across the outdoor recreation community. And our goal is to nurture an environment where all people have access to safe and welcoming outdoor experiences.
Well, somebody might be driving around hearing this and saying, well, doesn't everybody have access to the outdoors? And I think this coalition was formed in response to that question. Is that right?
Yes. A big thing that sits with me is I had a friend that said something around that. Like, you know, there's no one at the boat ramp. There's no one at the trailhead that's blocking Black people from getting on the water, getting on the trail. And where there might not be, you know, seemingly a barrier, there are barriers. There are physical barriers, there are social economic barriers, there are historical barriers that can prevent so many different people from getting there. For people with disabilities, you know, a lot of trail systems or outdoor recreation infrastructure is not designed to be accessible. There are sort of historical barriers. A lot of outdoor space for places of misery for folks. You think about like the Trail of Tears. You think about lynchings and things that have happened in the woods and in the forest. So there's just a lot of different barriers for folks. There's also like economic barriers as well. So yes, there's a lot of barriers.
So culturally, over generations, it's just become accepted that that's a place we don't go.
For some folks. Mm-hmm. For some folks, it is like that. I can say, you know, as a Black man, I didn't grow up in, like, I grew up in a military family. Mm-hmm. And so it was very, like, go outside, get outside. My mom and dad grew up in rural areas, so get outside, go outside. It wasn't like that for me. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of folks that, like, live in certain environments where they're not always connected with, a lot of folks have been disenfranchised or disconnected from the land, there is an association with fraught histories. You know, particularly in Kentucky, people associate London, Kentucky with sordid history because in, you know, the early 1900s, London was a sundown town, a town where they basically expelled all the Black people from there. Mm-hmm. And so it's kept that reputation, you know, for a while. And so there's things like that.
So how does Together Outdoors work to make the outdoors, make getting close to nature again, more accessible for more people?
Together Outdoors like works in a few different ways. So first of all, we're empowered by a coalition. We have, I think, 120 now coalition members from Fortune 500 outdoor companies, public agencies, and nonprofits. And so they collectively represent a huge swath of the community. So they have a lot of power to make change. That's one way. And we're doing it, you know, together. The other part is we have a really awesome advisory council and governance council that are folks, leaders from within these organizations, also grassroots inclusion advocates that provide us feedback and advice on how we should shape the initiative. And through their feedback and through our coalition's feedback, we've been able to create programs. We have one that we're working on with the Trust for Public Land called the Inclusive Spaces Program. Mm-hmm. And it's helping providing technical assistance to open space operators like parks, trail areas, campgrounds on how to make that space more accessible for folks. So thinking about things like tactile maps for folks that are blind, a de-escalation space for folks that are neurodivergent, thinking about transportation options to get to those areas. Is there public transportation that can take folks to that area? If there isn't, can there be that service provided? So that's one program that we're working on, and we're piloting that program in Chattanooga, Tennessee this fall, utilizing three sites there as our pilot sites to test out our methodology. Another program that we've been able to work on and do is design a resource hub so folks can learn about, because this is like really like, Tom, like this inclusion in the outdoors, it's an academic discipline. There's a lot of like thought process and articles and research papers that have gone into it. So we built this, and it's very new, a resource hub where people can search for books, articles, podcasts, research about inclusion in the outdoors. It also includes a database of organizations around the country that are doing inclusion work. So that if, you know, a company is trying to look to support a community that's doing that work, like say if I'm a fishing company, and I want to support, you know, folks that are disabled fishing, there are organizations that are doing that work. So I can connect with that org and become a funder of them, or say that I am, you know, a Black family in Kentucky, and I want to be in a comfortable space and go out on trips with folks. You can use our organizational directory to find organizations that are doing that. So that's been a big project we've worked on for the past year. And then another project that we just wrapped up the initial pilot round of is our grant program. So we designed a grant program that was targeted towards frontline inclusion organizations, organizations that are just getting started or that have less access to capital, like some of the more larger nonprofits. So we put out the application for the grant in on August 8th, and we had over 84 applicants, Tom.
Wow.
Representing nearly $800,000 worth of need. And that was like crazy, Tom, like to see like just in a short period of time, the people, and I'm reading through the proposals and they're amazing. There are things like folks that are making rock climbing accessible for folks that are disabled. So like how, like, you know, equipping them to go out on trips and take them rock climbing. Mm-hmm. There are folks that are creating fly fishing programs for indigenous youth in New Mexico. In Kentucky, there's a organization that applied that's trying to increase the diversity of horseback riding. So there's a lot of, like, we got a lot of really cool projects, and there's a lot of cool projects, a lot of need out there.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list of the coalition members, and I'm just in the A's here. And I'm seeing Airstream, as you mentioned, the American Horse Council, the American Hiking Society, American Sport Fishing Association, the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, Archery Trade Association, and it goes on and on and on. So the resources are really, really pretty robust, aren't they?
We're trying. We're trying. And, you know, the big thing, Tom, that we're trying to do is Together Outdoors is not out here to reinvent the wheel. You know, there have been for years folks of color, folks that are disabled, folks of like the queer LGBTQIA community that created spaces and done this work where they've carved out a space because there wasn't a space in the mainstream community. So they've been doing that work for years. Our work here with Together Outdoors is merely to amplify what's going on and build resources where we can. So that's been a really cool journey is being able to really like highlight those folks.
Well, Jerry, I know that you have for years now, you've been a staunch advocate for the value of just getting out there, getting in touch with our natural surroundings, and in your case, kayaking in particular. What does getting out on the water or out into the woods do for you?
It does a lot, Tom, for me. It helps with like my mental health. I think that's been a big thing that has come up over the past few years is mental health awareness. And it just helps because, like, you know, our day-to-day life, there's so much going on. You know, the pandemic, there's wars in our world. There's so many things going on. But being able to go out in the woods, go down the trail, go out in the water, for me, it's just relaxing. And it allows me to kind of forget some of those woes. And for me, it's been a really therapeutic thing. And when I first kind of, like, met you and we've been on this show before, I forgot to mention, but a lot of like the reasons like why I started getting outside more in Kentucky was because of some of the traumas that I went through when I was in college around like race and identity and stuff like that. And so being able to go outside would allow me to escape from those things. But also it allowed me to become an ambassador and allowed for me to help with the diversification of leadership in the outdoors for people to see a Black man in Kentucky, you know, leading this work. So it's just, there's a lot of meaningful and pride, you know, when I'm out there in my boat. And there's like multifaceted reasons.
Well, people hearing this, they may want to step up and see what they can do to help out. How can they get in touch?
Togetheroutdoors.com. Just check out our website. You know, we have a lot of things going on right now. We have like our resource hub that people can join in. We have gear, like shirts, hats, stickers. And we really want people to be rocking those, you know, so they can show people like, hey, like I'm about this inclusion in the outdoors and creating safe and welcoming spaces for all. And really right now, our big focus is on getting organizations to join the coalition. So parks organizations, marinas, outfitters, outdoor stores, we're really looking for those type of folks to join the coalition. And then for individuals, like I said, we have like merch, we have a resource hub, and then we will have ways for individuals to participate more robustly in the future.
All right. Well, this is very dynamic, and I'd like to follow it as it grows. So if you would please keep us in touch.
Oh, yeah.
That's Jerry Sivo James, Coalition Lead with Together Outdoors. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Thank you so much, Tom.
What do those local offices on the November 8th ballot actually do? We're detailing those job descriptions in our weekly Civic Short series in partnership with CivicLex and its director, Richard Young.
Today, we're talking about the mayor of the Lexington-Fayette Urban County Government. As the city's chief executive, the mayor supervises, administers, and governs all of governmental departments and is responsible for Fayette County as a whole. The mayor is the appointing authority for civil service employees and is responsible for overseeing LFUCG personnel. Each mayor assembles an administration that includes staff positions like the chief of staff, commissioners for each major city department, and a chief administrative officer who oversees commissioners and most of city government employees. The mayor also makes appointments to many boards and commissions, including the city's planning commission. The mayor's decisions are typically subject to confirmation by the Urban County Council, Lexington's legislative governmental body. For example, each year, the mayor presents a report on the state of the city and submits a budget to the council. That budget is developed with city staff and the mayoral administration, but then council amends and confirms the budget. In some cities, mayors are a regular voting member of the city council. In Lexington, the mayor presides over council meetings, but usually only votes to break a council tie. The mayor may also veto ordinances and resolutions adopted by the council, but that veto is subject to an override by a 3/5 vote of the Urban County Council. This rarely happens. Fayette County elects its mayor on a nonpartisan basis every 4 years. The mayor may serve up to 3 consecutive terms. Want more information on all things local government? You can check out our website at civiclex.org, subscribe to our CivicLex weekly newsletter, and follow us on social media.
For information about other local offices appearing on the November 8th ballot, visit the Civic Shorts tab on our site, esweku.org. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. And if you'd like to call something to our attention or suggest a topic, email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.